This is Robert Travis Scott, president of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana. I'm sitting in today for Jim Inkster. Well, joining us on the show are two journalists at the State Capitol Beat who have a lot to tell us about what really happened in the legislative session that ended Thursday. Melinda DeLotte with the Associated Press Capitol Bureau and Jeremy Alford, a writer with Law Politics. And Jeremy has an entertaining column out today about the bizarre political alliances in the legislature, and he'll be telling us more about that. Also on the show, John LeBlanc, the tax and finance expert at the Louisiana Association for Business and Industry. He's got some strong views about what should and shouldn't happen during the legislative session. And we've also got U.S. Congressman Cedric Richmond representing the newly drawn 2nd District, which now includes northern Baton Rouge as well as the New Orleans area. Today on the Jim Inkster Show. And now the news. Good morning and welcome to the Jim Inkster Show. I'm Robert Travis Scott, the president of the Public Affairs Research Council of Louisiana. I'm sitting in for Jim today. And we'd love to hear your calls for our guests in the Baton Rouge area. That's 297-5633, 297-5633, or toll-free at 877-217-5757. We have in the studio with us today Jeremy Alford with Law Politics, the teammate of John McGinnis for that very fine news service covering Capitol Views. And we also have on the phone John LeBlanc, who is a terrific tax and finance analyst with the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. Good morning, Jeremy, and good morning, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great. Well, I'm going to kick off with Jeremy. We just had the session ending on Thursday, and you had a really good column that you came out with today. We're talking about the sort of unusual political alliances that have emerged out of this most recent session. It isn't the simple Democrat versus Republican scenario that you usually hear.
No, most certainly not. I think most people know by now that we ended up with a balanced budget, and there's a bit of a kumbaya feeling coming out of the session by lawmakers. We saw the fiscal hawks, which are conservative members of the Republican Party mostly, teaming up with Democrats and members of the Black Caucus. And I think what we're seeing happen in the House is some new divisions forming. I think during Governor Kathleen Blanco's final year, it was a big deal that Republicans were able to form a caucus that made a dent. When Bobby Jindal came in, Republicans took more seats, and it was a big deal that we were starting to get a real two-party system in Louisiana, even as Republicans took over control of the legislature. But I think what we have now is almost a four-party system.
A four-party system.
I've spoken to many mainline Republicans who feel like they've been stabbed in the back by the fiscal hawks, that they were disappointed that they would form a coalition with the Black Caucus and members of the Democratic Party. And also on the other side, I've talked to Democrats who were upset about the way that members of the Black Caucus independently kind of pushed their own priorities going into the end of session during the budget negotiations.
But at the end of the day, on the last day of the session, they all seemed very harmonious, like they were ready to sing kumbaya and hold hands.
And I think on the Democratic side that those wounds are going to be easier to heal, but I think on the Republican side that we're going to see that resentment carry over into the next session.
I heard there was kind of a showdown meeting with the GOP members in the final day.
There was. That's really where you started to see the divide happen between the mainline general Republicans and the fiscal hawks. There were a couple of...
This was a meeting of the GOP caucus?
GOP caucus, right.
And what did this happen, Wednesday night? Or
Wednesday evening, I believe.
Or Tuesday evening, one of those nights?
And we headed into the final days.
Yeah, and what
there's
happened?
a bit of finger-pointing, a bit of screaming. Mm-hmm. I think at one point a mainline Republican jumped up and told the hawks that they need a falconeer.
And some control over their hawkiness.
Right. And of course, the fiscal hawks organized before the session. They rebranded under the name Budget Reform Coalition, but everybody just kept calling them the fiscal hawks. I don't think you can name yourself after a flying predator and not see it stick.
Well, John, you've been an observer of legislative sessions going way back. Tell us your point of view of what happened with the session, and do you think there's a lot of interesting divisions, or is there a lot of harmony over there?
Well, Robert, as you remember, we started the session probably back in November, December with the Revenue Study Commission, which was supposed to lead into the tax reform discussion. And during the tax reform discussion, there was a lot of discussion about improving the business climate in Louisiana. They were talking about tax court and single tax collector and some substantive tax issues that were going to kind of bring Louisiana forward a little further. And as you know, on the first day of session, the governor parked his tax bills, and soon thereafter, the entire legislature, under the leadership of Joe Robideau, Representative Robideau, they parked the rest of the legislature's tax reform. And kind of like from there, really the focus of session sort of changed toward the budget.
And that budget at the very end, as the House and the Senate and these different four political parties were hashing it all out, they came to a deal in the legislature, and then Governor Jindal stepped up, I guess, the night before the big deal, and said there was a deal. Jeremy, was that the case? Was he the leader of getting the budget together?
Well, there are a lot of upset lawmakers that next morning. You talk to senators and representatives, and I've heard from many that Governor Jindal was nowhere near the table that evening, that they had struck a deal before they met with the governor, and the governor, took the initiative to announce it to the rest of the world before they could even go back and talk to the different factions that came to the agreement.
So, John, what did you make of the budget deal at the end of the day? It was kind of a standstill budget in terms of the amount of money we were spending this year versus this coming year. Did you think it was a good budget?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell. I guess it'll play out, but it was difficult getting to this. I mean, midway through session, I guess three-quarters through session, when the House was still trying to figure out the dollars versus, you know, all the one-time dollars and also the new revenues. I mean, the legislature has not generated new revenues in the form of tax increases in a very long while, and it took them quite a while to kind of hone in on exactly what they were going to do. Partly through process, they were going to look at things like the inventory tax and the machinery and equipment exemption, and eventually those all came off the table, and they looked at doing some things with vendors comp and a few other incentive programs and the like. So it was very challenging to get to the point where they were going to kind of focus in on the revenues that they were looking at. But between the new revenues, a new amnesty plan, and, you know, Robert, midway through session, the REC recognized more dollars. So when the bill went over from the House to the Senate had a lot more to play with than the House did.
The REC, well, that would be the group that figures out how much revenue we're going to get in the next fiscal year. And they said, hey, we're going to make a little bit more money than we thought. So that means they could spend a little bit more.
That's exactly right. And, you know, everyone's kind of crossing their fingers that these new budget reforms that led by the fiscal hawks, if you will, that's going to, maybe minimize mid-year budget cuts. And I guess that's left to be seen, you know, because, you know, if we do have a downtick in oil or a downtick in the natural gas prices or just about anything else, I mean, it is going to cause a situation for mid-year budget cuts, even with these sorts of budget reforms that have been put in place.
297-5633. Give us a call if you have a question for one of these gentlemen who have been following affairs at the state capitol. This is Robert Scott sitting in for Jim Inkster on the show today. You know, John, there's a lot of discussion about this session about these tax exemptions, all of these big breaks that all the lobbyists give to all these businesses, according to the way that it's been broken down. I wonder if you could give us your perspective on that. Was there supposed to be some peeling back of some of these exemptions as a way of producing more revenue for the state? And are these kind of accusations fair?
Well, Robert, they started reviewing the tax exemption budget, which has a lot of things in there which aren't truly tax exemptions. For example, if you lower someone's rate from 4% to 3% because you think it's a good tax policy, that goes in the books as a tax exemption. But they've been studying, and I have to say, they studied the entire tax exemption line by line for, since September through February. They literally went through each item. And all these special interest groups, if you will, were given a chance to vocalize their opposition or support of each one. And I have to say that I think they did a very thorough job. But, you know, like I said, it's very difficult to put everything on par with each other. For example, you know, lowering a tax rate to incentivize a certain amount of activity, it goes into books as a tax exemption. So that's where the session started with review. I've been hearing some people in the hallways in the Capitol is, look, you know, we've already been through the review of the tax exemption budget. Now it's time to review the entire budget. The tax exemption budget, whether you like it or not, may be somewhere between $6 and $7 billion, whereas the general appropriations bill is in a $24 to $25 billion range. So if we really want to look at whether or not we're getting a bang for our buck, let's not just look at it on the tax side. Let's look at the entire budget, and hopefully that's where the tension is going to turn.
Jeremy, what did you make of how lawmakers were approaching these exemptions? I mean, they said they were going to, you know, attack a lot of these and try to peel some of them back, but in the end, they did very little. I guess they touched the enterprise zones, the solar credits.
Right. Well, I think a lot of the tax burden was going to fall on the back of business, and I think John could speak to this, but business organized very quickly. I think they made their case succinctly to lawmakers. It seemed like every time any kind of real tax discussion did happen this session, it did fall on the back of business, and you got a reaction that you thought would happen. I think the bigger question is, because of what happened this session, because of the violent outcry we saw at the beginning of the session, has Governor Jindal and the legislature poisoned the well for substantive tax reform before he leaves office?
Well, he's made it tough to come back to the subject of tax reform anytime soon, hasn't he?
Right. And, of course, we have to wait a couple of years because tax proposals are only considered during odd-numbered years.
Well, John, did you have meetings with the lieutenants of the governor who were forming these tax plans as they were all evolving over the months leading up to the session?
We met with them just like other groups had met with them, but it was very high-level talks, 50,000-foot talks, if you will, before they had kind of honed in on the exacts. And it wasn't until very late in the process. I mean, Robert, you remember the term of art was revenue neutral. Everything was going to be revenue neutral. How could it be bad? How could anybody not like revenue neutral tax reform?
That means for every tax cut amount, you have to find a way to make up for that with some revenue increase so that you're not having a big cut in the state budget or a big boost in the state budget.
That's right. So revenue neutral is sort of in the eyes of the beholder. If you're looking at it from the state level, then there really isn't that much attention to which groups are bearing the burden. But when toward the beginning of session, after the plan kind of got finalized, it was revealed that it was going to be revenue neutral to the state, but to the business community, it was going to be starting at a $500 million tax swap. And a substantial portion of that was because of this new business services tax. The proposal was to start taxing all sorts of business services that were not traditionally taxed. And that's where businesses were going to pay about 80% of that new business service tax. That was difficult for us to see how this was improving the business climate in Louisiana by this new tax.
I think it was difficult as well for members of the Ways and Means Committee. I think the governor has been very effective at taking the boards and committees that are important, that are at pressure points in the policy and political process, and loading them with people that support his stance and his ideology. Well, and so the. You stack this committee full of members who would never pass a tax, and now all of a sudden you're asking them to pass a tax. It was I tell you the house at the beginning of the session was just a powder keg waiting to go off.
Is that right? They were primed for sort of pushback.
Right, and I think that's why you saw John spoke about Joel Robideau, the chairman of Ways and Means, who really maybe more so than anyone else stopped the tax plan and stopped any taxes from moving out of the committee. But I think if this was any other session, I think Joel Robideau may have lost his chairmanship. I think that would have made him a martyr. I think that would have made the House explode.
The governor would have had enough influence to remove him from that post, is what you're saying. But that didn't happen this time. 297-5633. Jeremy, is the governor lost control of the legislature? I think the Times-Picayune said that the legislature had taken on Jindal and won.
The governor is still the governor. It's one of the most powerful governors in the nation. I think the governor didn't really have much of a choice but to sit on the sidelines for a little bit this session.
Good. Sonny Landreth's going to take us out here. We'll be back in just a couple of moments for more with Jeremy Alford and John LeBlanc. Stay with us. It's going to be good. Robert Travis Scott sitting in here for Jim Inkster. We've got Jeremy Alford with Law Politics and John LeBlanc, our tax expert at Law B. A little bit later, we'll have U.S. Congressman Cedric Richmond on. Cedric Richmond, not only the only Democratic congressman for Louisiana, but also a very fine baseball pitcher. We may hear a little bit about his athletic activities. 297-5633, 297-5633, or toll-free at 877-217-5757. Come in and join the conversation. Jeremy, as we were going out in the last segment, you're talking about the independence of the legislature. Has the legislature asserted independence, and if so, why?
I think they have this session. I think that's clear. What remains to be seen is if they're able to do it in future sessions. I think one of the largest contributing factors to their independence this session was the fact that Jindal, the governor, created a leadership vacuum. And I think he chose to do so. I think the way the session started out with him having to park his tax plan forced him onto the sidelines.
Well, you know, when the session began, it began in such an unusual way. It started out with the governor parking his tax plan and then not really giving any direction or motivation for the legislature about what to do next.
He asked lawmakers. He told lawmakers, bring me a plan. He didn't give them any specifics or instructions. And I guess it was the legislature's choice to give him no plan.
John, you're still with us?
Yes.
Listen, is an independent legislature a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you've been hearing over years how, like Jeremy just said, we have one of the most powerful governors in the country, and I think it was good for the legislature to show their independence, but there was a part during session where some leadership from above would have been helpful, and, you know, it did take the legislature some time to kind of fill themselves out. Like I said, there were some... You know, we know how it ended up, but there were a lot of discussions on the way there to the end, which could have brought us down a very bad path from a tax standpoint and from a business standpoint. And, you know, from a session where we were looking forward to the session of improving the business climate here in Louisiana, the session could have taken multiple turns during this process where, I have to say, when you know, leaving session, when we would not have improved the business climate here in Louisiana. So it was sort of touch and go a couple of times. I think they got it as well as they could. But I think this is where you see in the past where where the governor kind of led the budget discussion. And as Jeremy was saying, this is the time where I think the legislature pretty much did on their own.
I think the governor's going to be back. I think he's over these past 6 years, he's proven that he is a governor with big ideas. He always comes to the forefront of a session with those, and I don't think next year is going to be an exception.
John in Lafayette, you have a question.
Yes, good morning. I'm concerned about higher education. I speak to professors here in Lafayette about what's happening to higher education, and they're saying that maybe the university here will have a hard time ever recovering from these cuts. As I understand it, it's now to less than 3% of the total budget going to higher education. Am I right about that?
Well, I know, I think since Governor Jindal took office, the last I heard, including this most current budget, higher education has been cut by 65%. I know at LSU, before the last-minute budget changes, the money going to LSU from the general appropriations bill was less than the state's mandated spending for those campuses. And what you're seeing happen, and LSU, the flagship university, is a perfect example, is private interests are having to play more of an important role. That's why you see the largest Barnes & Noble bookstore on any campus in America at LSU, and it's why you see the LSU Foundation really doubling down to try to increase their endowment.
And to follow up on John's, from Lafayette's question, John, with Law B, is higher education funding and it's the state of it, is that causing a problem for business in the long term?
In the long term, this is an important issue, but I think we need to kind of take a step back a little bit and remember that a lot of this funding that we're, quote, cutting from is from levels that we had never seen before. You know, in 07 and 08 and 09, then we had the federal stimulus money in 10 and 11, we had billions and billions of these one-time dollars that were pumped into education and higher ed. and even healthcare. And now we're still trying to find our way down to this to the normal level. And that's why when you hear that the general fund funding is going down, is because a lot of this money was coming from statutory dedications of dollar of these one-time dollars. And you know, we've been dealing with this for the last couple of years of sort of kind of coming down from these one-time dollars, and I think you're starting to see a leveling off period here.
Yeah, I think the exception is the TOPS program. There's a good deal of one-time money going into to floating TOPS this year, and I also think the appropriation from the general fund this year is the smallest ever going toward TOPS.
Yeah, and the TOPS program we're talking about, basically the state's way of funding tuition for students who qualify to go to college. And what we've seen happen, I guess, is the tuition has been going up. The state sort of general support, if you will, for the higher education institutions has been going down. But while that tuition goes up, the state is paying for the tuition through the TOPS program. And so the budget for TOPS continues to increase as the tuition goes up. Is there a dilemma here for the budget process? Is this a functional way to go forward, gentlemen?
I think there's a lot of unanswered questions when it comes to TOPS. It grows every year. Speaking of higher education, though, something else that riled higher education this session was a bill that was passed by Senator Robert Adley. It was $250 million worth of construction projects that are going to go to the technical and community colleges. I know the business was happy to see that because of the workforce needs around the state. But a lot of folks are predicting that higher ed is going to come to the table next year and ask for the same sort of program.
Well, and you mean the regular four-year institutions will come and ask for the same type of thing. Yeah, we're talking about a $250 million bill that will be paying out over the years for all these building projects at the community and technical colleges across the state. Almost every institution got some type of new building of some kind.
Right.
The one here in Baton Rouge is actually a very stimulating, interesting project. It's for car maintenance and repair, and that's something that we really need here. Hang on just a second. We've got Ellen in Sherwood. Ellen, you're online.
Hi.
Welcome to the Jim Inkster Show.
Thank you. Your guest, I think, mentioned earlier that there had been a lot of one-time funds that went into education and went into other things. But the fact also is that Governor Jindal decided to repeal the Stelly tax, which was a fair income tax, and he has such a maniacal aversion to any kind of taxes, and this would solve the problem. They wouldn't have to have all these cuts. There wouldn't be 65% cuts to education and his refusal to have Medicare in the state. This is just outrageous, and the people need to stand up to him and say, we're not going to take it anymore.
All right, gentlemen, higher taxes, is that the answer? John?
Well, I don't think so. I think we just experienced sort of the trial run, if you will, for higher taxes. And, you know, if you go back to 08 and 09, we had billions and billions of one-time, you know, stimulus money, windfalls from the storms. A lot of budgets went up 20, 30, 40%. But yet, you know, outcomes didn't really change here in Louisiana. So, you know, we've already had a little experience with influxes of new dollars, and you've put it into this system that's less than efficient, and you got the same outcome. So more money is not the answer. What we need to do is do a better job with the dollars we have. And, you know, if you think we have a struggling economy right now with the uncertainties of the Affordable Health Care Act, hiring employees, put on the backs of businesses some uncertain new taxes, and you're really going to see the economy slow down.
It sounds like the Medicaid expansion issue is one that we may hear of again. I think it was $18 billion left on the table by not accepting President Obama's expansion. I know that would have covered 214,000 people in the state roughly a quarter, I believe, are in New Orleans. And that's a lot of people view that largely as a political issue. Republicans in the House opposed it, but also Governor Bobby Jindal kind of led the way. And it helps him differentiate himself from other Republican governors around the nation.
Well, Jindal, during the session, helped block the Medicaid expansion that a lot of legislators wanted to put out there. They were doing a vote on it. It wasn't very clear that even if they endorsed a Medicaid expansion that it would actually happen because the governor apparently is in charge on that issue. But he fought back the Medicaid expansion. He was in favor of this $250 million community and technical colleges building program that went out. There are probably a number of things that he got his way on during the session.
Certainly.
What's left in the future? How much more influence does he have? He's got two more sessions. Is he a lame duck at this point, or is there a lot more that he can accomplish?
It's hard to call someone with $4 million in the campaign finance account a lame duck. It's going to be interesting to see what he does with that money. But like we've always said, I mean, the Louisiana governor is always going to be the Louisiana governor. He's always going to have his hands around the purse strings on the capital outlay budget, which are construction projects that have traditionally been used by governors to reward or punish lawmakers. I don't think any of that's going to change.
Well, John, there's 2 years left in the governor's term. There must be things that Labi would like to see accomplished in the future. Is there something you would like to see this administration do in the way of reforms related to finances or taxes or other issues?
Well, Robert, that's a great question. And on the platform for this year, Project Session, were two or three or four things that could bring Louisiana to the forefront. And one of which is, you know, I know you're familiar with, and maybe your listeners are, this concept of collecting the internet taxes, if you will, and creating a single tax collector here in Louisiana. You know, and just like what you call it was saying, new taxes, well, there's tax dollars out there that aren't being collected because there's some constitutional issues and the like.
Well, tell us, what is the system we have now? I think probably a lot of people don't understand what you're talking about a single collector. We're an outlier as far as tax collections is concerned.
That's right. You know, in Louisiana, we have sort of a two-tiered system. We have a state system of sales tax and a local system. Most other states, almost every other state, has a single system where the state, if you will, collects both the state and the local sales taxes, whereas Louisiana, Colorado, Arizona, and Alabama have this hybrid system where the state collects the state. In some other states, the state actually collects some of the locals, but Louisiana has a two-tiered system. And I guess based upon federal law and the Constitution, we cannot require remote sellers to collect our sales tax in Louisiana.
And remote sellers would include like internet sales.
Internet, exactly, those kind of things. And people always wonder, why can't we make them collect? Well, because the federal laws say that we cannot put this burden on these out-of-state collectors to collect our tax. And almost every state in the country doesn't have this issue, but yet Louisiana does. And Robert, I do want to tell you that these other states that we're aligned with, Colorado and Arizona, they have made some strides at this session to make their laws more efficient, and which would allow them to begin to collect some of these internet taxes.
So 297-5633, call and join us. John, on the same subject, if you're a retailer or someone else who is collecting sales tax as part of your business, and you have operations or stores in multiple parishes, what is it like for you in Louisiana?
That's a great question, Robert. Remember, we have a two-tiered system. So if you're in East Baton Rouge Parish, but you make deliveries to these outlying parishes like West Baton Rouge and Ascension, you have to file monthly tax returns in each one of these parishes. And there was some great debate during session, if you remember, on the vendor's comp issue. And when everyone talks about who collects the sales taxes in the state, the businesses are the collectors of the tax in Louisiana. And it's a huge obligation and a responsibility that we place on businesses. And like the testimony during session, if they get it wrong, they're responsible. If they collect 7% and they should have been collecting 8%, just because it was just maybe that the laws were a little too complex, the businesses have to pay that burden, have to pay that price.
Well, you're talking about the compensation that the state gives to businesses for collecting the tax, and I was really referring to that reform effort to try to centralize the tax collection system in Louisiana so that businesses will not have to face multiple filing systems in multiple parishes and different audits and so on. It's a very complicated state to do business in on a retail front.
That's exactly right, and most people in Louisiana don't realize that we are sort of out there by ourselves.
And why are we out there by ourselves?
Well, it's just sort of the way we, you know, the way our tax policy has originated. We initially gave the locals the ability to collect their local tax, and I have to tell you, Robert, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was even a more inefficient system, where within any parish, say for example, East Baton Rouge Parish. Each taxing jurisdiction was allowed to collect their own tax. So, for example, the school board, the sheriff, the levy district.
That must have really been the Wild West.
Absolutely. And it required a constitutional amendment to be passed to force each parish to have one collector. That still puts us sort of in a huge minority of other states. For example, Mississippi, Texas, Arkansas, they have just one collector of all their taxes, and it really makes it easy on businesses to comply.
I think there were a lot of people who thought this was going to be the reform of this session that would really
come through. It didn't happen. That's right. So
this is something Bobby Jindal could still pursue in the rest of his 2 years. He could probably take on this issue if he wanted to and bring a 19th century system into at least the late 20th century, if not the 21st century.
And there's several reasons to do that. For one is there's tax dollars out there. This isn't a new tax. It's a tax collection issue. And also, if you want to get in the mainstream and put Louisiana sort of on the same path as almost every other state in the country when it comes to the efficiencies in collecting these taxes, and also it will put us sort of on the path to be able to collect these internet taxes, that's something we still need to look at.
Okay, Bruce and Walden, really quickly, you have a question.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I represent an association of about 500 small businesses, and not taking the Medicaid expansion is putting about two-thirds of our members at risk of bankruptcy, because we're going to be responsible for coverage which would have been taken care of by the expansion. So this isn't talked about nearly enough. Not taking the expansion is an incredible attack on mid-sized businesses throughout the state.
Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate that. Jeremy, do you think that Medicaid expansion is going to come back as a topic? And
that's what I've heard in the hallways. And just for folks know, Governor Jindal didn't just reject the expansion out of hand. You know, he had an argument that there are some unknown fiscal elements that it could end up costing the state more. But the fact of the matter is, I believe the first year would have been covered 100%. The legislature did another study that said it would have saved the state money during the first decade.
Jeremy Alford with Law Politics, John LeBlanc with Law B. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on our show today. Glad we have
some
great experts out there. Join us for the next segment of the Jim Inkster Show. Robert Travis Scott here, sitting in for Jim. Come on back and join us. It's going to be good. Well, good. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. This is Robert Travis Scott sitting in for Jim Inkster. We are about to hear from Congressman Cedric Richmond, who we will be calling in. In the meantime, we've had a good session with Jeremy Alford and John LeBlanc, who have been talking about the legislative session as it's been coming together, and we'd very much like to talk a little bit more about the session and what happened. The Public Affairs Research Council, of which I am president, we had a commentary out just on Friday about the legislative session and all of the different events that transpired. I think what we saw was a situation where the budget, you know, which was basically a standstill budget, was hello there? Who have we got?
Yes.
Cedric? Hello?
Hey, this is John again, Robert.
Oh, hey, John. How are you? Thanks for coming back on. I appreciate it. We were just talking about We're waiting for Cedric Richmond to call in the meantime. We're talking about the session and some of the things that transpired there. You know, it seems to me, John, that we had a session that was kind of a defining moment for the legislature, although I think that legislatures like to have some direction from the governor. It's hard for a deliberative body like that to sort of form up like a tightly strategized corporation and figure out what's next. I think quite often they benefit from having a governor who can come in and help give them some direction and leading. And do you think that's probably necessary for the future?
Yeah, and like I said, Robert, when we start off on the tax reform discussion, there was leadership from up top, and it was sort of filtering down to the legislative level, except that, I mean, you were involved somewhat in the process as well as I was. And unless you have all the information, unless you know the impact of what you're proposing, it's very difficult to kind of do this in a vacuum. And there was a lot of time and effort put in on the front end to try to collect the right numbers and the right dollars. And I think you saw throughout the process, even when it kind of fell apart, there was still a lot of uncertainty out there on whether or not the numbers were right and whether or not we were missing something. So that was a very challenging exercise, I thought, because unless you have your fingers on the pulse of all the information, you're kind of proposing things sort of in the dark, if you will.
Great. Hey, John, I want you to hang on. We're going to have Cedric Richmond come in, talk to him for a few minutes. Thanks for joining us. Cedric Richmond, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for joining us on the Jim Inkster Show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Hey, now where are you today? Are you in Washington? Are you in New Orleans?
I'm in New Orleans. We go up tomorrow.
That's great. And because you get back into action up in the nation's capital.
Well, I mean, generally what happens is either on Monday or Tuesday we fly up with first votes postponed till 6:30 that night, and then we'll work the remainder of the week. And on the last day of the week, votes are usually ending around 3, and that way both of those days allow for travel. And now most, if not all, members of Congress still live in their home district, so they fly back and forth every week.
All right, we're at 297-5633 if you have a question for U.S. Congressman Cedric Richmond. Cedric, you're no stranger to Baton Rouge. I think most people think of your district, the 2nd District, as being a New Orleans district. But after redistricting, your district comes all the way up the river through Donaldsonville, and it covers several areas in northern Baton Rouge, Scotlandville, Marydale. So you are a Baton Rouge representative as well as a New Orleans representative.
Absolutely. We take in Baker, Zachary, and we really combine all the river parishes, too. So the New Orleans Chamber of Congress, the Baton Rouge Chamber of Commerce, got together and created something called the Super Region, which really mirrors my district because it takes in all of the river parishes and then Baton Rouge, which if the state is going to grow, if we're going to continue to move in a positive manner, we have to make sure that that entire region prospers. That's Baton Rouge, the river parishes with manufacturing, oil and gas, and all of those things, and the city of New Orleans and Jefferson Parish.
So some people might look at the district and say it's awfully spread out and it would be difficult to cover, but what you're saying is that it actually fits with a regional view of where we're going in this area.
I believe so. And it just so happens that the chambers of commerce were coming together to put this together anyway. But between probably Cassidy, Scalise, and myself, I think that it all covers what is critical to the future of New Orleans economic development, future of Louisiana economic development-wise.
Well, now, you are no stranger to Baton Rouge. You were a state legislator for, I believe, about 11 years. Spent a lot of time at the state capitol. I believe that after Katrina, you, like a lot of folks in New Orleans, spent some time living here. And I think you were also a very dear friend of Avon Honey, who was a state legislator from up around the Southern University area. Is that right?
Correct. And after the storm, I lived in Baton Rouge for a while, almost a year. in between Avon Honey's house, which Avon lived out in the St. Pius area, which is in the 2nd Congressional District now. But being in the legislature 11 years, going back and forth to Baton Rouge, you develop a good sense for the Baton Rouge community. And really, it sounds cliche, but I think the interest of Louisianans all in this southeast region is similar in terms of the urban areas needing police and fire protection, fighting crime. And then up and down the river, New Orleans, Jefferson, it's about infrastructure and protecting homes and investments from flooding. And in the big urban cities, it's still about pushing for economic development, improving education, reforming it so every kid has an opportunity. So those themes are very common throughout this area. And the other thing that I think that this district, we have a keen interest in high-speed rail that could connect Baton Rouge to Orleans.
Yeah, I know that that's been a subject that a lot of folks have talked about, and we're going to go to Lynn in Melrose, who has a similar question about Louisiana Swift, that bus service. Lynn?
Yes, Representative Richmond, I was surprised to read that, you know, on Friday DOTD announced that they're going to cut the L.A. Swift program, which has become a staple for a lot of people who don't have cars and who commute between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Very practical system, and I'm just curious whether your district would certainly be affected by that. I'm curious whether you could offer a bill to reinstate the federal subsidy that keeps it going, or to allow for a fare increase to, if I understand it right, an increase from $10 round trip to $16 or something would offset the loss of the federal money.
Thank you, Lynn. Well, Cedric, what do you think about bus service until we can get that train running?
Well, I think bus service is critical, and I'm a little disappointed that the decision was made in a vacuum to cut the service, and I understand that budgets are tight, but before you cut something that's critical, and I think it's just a good idea to get people in the habit of doing that, is to reach out and see if you can't find some federal allies and some federal partners. So you can let Lynn know, and Lynn, if you're still there, that it's something that we'll start working on immediately, and I'll call my friends in the legislature to figure out what those numbers are and what we would need to do.
Well, you know, Cedric, a lot of what we hear about Congress is just the constant fighting between Republicans and Democrats, and then it's a big partisan battle. But some of what you're saying is that a lot of your work really has less to do with politics than it does about district service and just trying to get our infrastructure protected and advanced here.
I think that's the biggest thing. And coming from the Louisiana legislature, where I could pass legislation when I needed to or when the constituents needed, in this Congress, you're just not passing a lot of legislation. It is very, very difficult in this toxic atmosphere. However, when people have problems, we're really able to solve them. And that's the part that keeps our sanity, is the fact that when constituents have problems with the VA, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or any of the federal departments, we can intervene on their behalf, and we usually can make a really big difference. I mean, our best story is the fact that a guy was fighting with Social Security for 10 years. We got involved, and Social Security finally realized that they made a mistake, and they had to write them a check for $96,000. So those are the types of things that we can absolutely do. But we are one of the few that can team with Republicans on issues and pass legislation. You know that we're facing a big flood insurance increase in our river parishes and some of our cities because of flood insurance reform. Well, last week we teamed up with Congressman Cassidy to offer an amendment on this latest Armed Services Appropriations Bill so that we could delay it. And Cassidy was able to bring 100 or so Republicans. We were able to bring 190 Democrats. So we were able to pass it. When a lot of amendments and things of that nature are not passing, our delegation has been pretty successful in bringing a few Republicans and me bringing a good number of Democrats.
We have Nick downtown who has a question. Nick, you're on the Jim Meister Show.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning,
Congressman Richmond. I'm a lifelong resident of Louisiana, and I've seen as an African-American us go from two African-American congressional representatives to now just you, sir. So what I'm curious about is this. Do you think that we are, as African-Americans, that we're adequately represented with you as a congressman who's covering a district that includes pretty much an area from New Orleans down here to East Baton Rouge Parish? And with all due respect, I've never met you. I've worked here for a number of years, and I've never met you, and I'm just curious about if you think that that we're adequately represented. And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Congressman?
I think we're absolutely adequately represented. I think we have some of the best representation. And if you're trying to single it down to representation, then I don't think it distinguishes it. But I am a proud African-American. I take pride in the fact that I'm a member of Congress, and I make sure that on those issues that are disproportionately impact African-Americans or issues where we need to focus, whether it's New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Shreveport, Monroe, Lake Providence, which is still the poorest place in the country, that those issues are so critical that we focus on those and spend a lot of time on those also. So I'm not sure two is always better than one, but the one that we have, which is me, I think that we have the capability to do an extremely good job in doing it. And in terms of Baton Rouge, Southern University of New Orleans, within the Congressional Black Caucus, I lead the HBCU initiative because I knew that between Grambling, Southern, SUNO, Southern Law School, Xavier, Dillard, HBCU education in Louisiana has a very important role to play in terms of making sure that every kid has a chance at higher education, which is your best way out of poverty. So in a short answer, I think we have great representation. Two is better than one, but the one that we have can adequately do it.
Well, I can't let you get away, Congressman, without talking about the truly important subject, is that you have been the star pitcher at the congressional baseball game every year. You were a great pitcher at Morehouse College in Atlanta, went on to Tulane University Law School, and since you became a congressman, you've been drafted, I guess, as the lead pitcher for the congressional team. You play for the Democrats, right?
I play for the Democrats, and many people don't know, but it's a game that's been going on for over 100 years. I think it's 102 years old. It will be maybe the 52nd game. Some years in war and other times they actually didn't play the game, but it was started 102 years ago.
And wait, so this is an annual baseball game between Democrats and Republicans in Congress, right?
Right. We raise money for the Boys and Girls Club and the Literacy Foundation in D.C. But the good thing about it is it creates some great, great relationships. So when you hear me say that the Republican members can bring about 100 or so members, or sometimes a lot more than that, and I can generally bring a lot of Democrats, a lot of that has to do with the relationships you build.
Well, what's the relationship when you strike them out? Now, you were, I guess last year the Democrats won 18-5. That was your second win in a row as a pitcher. Is that not right?
It was. We're just hitting better than them right now, and we have a little better pitching than them right now. So this year it'll probably be very competitive again. The game is Thursday, and we get about 9,000 people out to National Stadium.
How about that? So you play in the big ballpark on the big show and on that venue, and you will be pitching again?
Yes.
And do you have – what are your best pitches, Cedric? A fastball? You have an off-speed pitch? Or what?
This year I'll throw fastball, curveball, and I'll mix in a little knuckleball.
A little knuckleball. Okay. Now, here's the question. Have you pitched against Steve Scalise batting?
I have, and Steve has gone around the entire state and the entire country bragging about his hit that he got off of me last year.
How about that? So Steve Scalise gets a hit on Cedric Richmond.
Right. But I did strike him out twice after that.
That's good. That's pretty good. Representative Cedric Richmond, thank you very much for joining us on the Jim Meingster Show today. Good luck to you up in Washington and all the battles you have there. This is Robert Travis Scott sitting in for Jim Meingster. I'll be in again tomorrow. I'll have John Georges, who just bought The Advocate from the Manship family, and we'll have Rolf McAllister, the founder of Louisiana Business Incorporated, which publishes the Business Report and other related journals. Join us for talking about the big men on campus and publishing in Louisiana.
Podcasts of The Jim Meingster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Meingster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.